This is BBC Radio 3. It's just after 27 minutes to 10. And now the satirist Joe Queenan presents the Sunday feature, A Brief History of Cunning.
Cunning, adjective. Meaning one, clever, sly, or crafty.
Late in the year of 2007, a young American student suddenly burst onto the pages of the world's press. Her name was Amanda Knox, and she was one of three suspects in a brutal murder case that took place in the Italian town of Perugia. The outcome of that case doesn't interest us here. What is of interest is the phrase, self-assured and cunning, that a panel of judges used to describe Foxy Knoxy in denying her bail. A cunning and foxy American student suddenly caught up in a terrible trial. What headline writer worth his salt could resist a combination like that?
Cunning, adjective, meaning two. Ingenious, skillful, or subtle.
Most of us think we know what cunning means. But on closer inspection, it's a far more layered, nuanced, and complicated word than you'd imagine.
Look, when I hear someone playing a violin beautifully, I think it's fantastic. When I hear them playing the fiddle, I think it's energetic, but it doesn't grab me. I think when you see something which you know has been achieved through cunning, and you can't really figure out how or who did it, it's a great skill. It's quite exciting.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Over the Top Productions. In our brief history of cunning, you'll hear from this man.
There can be no whitewash at the White House.
And this man.
What it amounts to for the individual is that they must have control. That is the key thing.
And I'll be traveling to Italy, home of Machiavelli and Berlusconi and innumerable other practitioners of the dark arts.
Machiavelli is talking in his book about rulers. He understands that all politics is about pure power.
And this man.
You might very well think that. You know I couldn't possibly comment.
Francis Urquhart, the fictional British Prime Minister in the BBC's House of Cards. Fiction has thrown up more than its fair share of intriguing characters, beginning with the serpent in the Garden of Eden. You could say that the eating of the forbidden fruit marks the moment cunning was born. So, having put down a marker for antediluvian biblical wile, let's move on to the ancient Greeks.
Okay, my name is Edith Hall, and I'm Professor of Classics at Royal Holloway, University of London.
Can we talk about Odysseus?
We can talk about Odysseus if you want to. One of the good reasons to talk about Odysseus is that one of the things that his name means is actually to diss somebody, to disrespect them.
Why does he have the reputation for being cunning?
Because in the Odyssey, he's given a variety of actual tricks or tasks which illustrate different kinds of mental ingenuity and planning. for navigating by the stars or building a raft or poking out a one-eyed creature's eye with a red-hot stake.
And having the other men hide underneath a sheep so that he won't notice that they're leaving the cave.
Well, exactly. Or when he wants to listen to the divine music of the sirens, getting himself lashed to the mast so that however many times he wanted to jump overboard, he didn't. I actually think one of the most important elements of Odysseus is the one that's usually translated versatile. It's a Greek word, polutropos. It just means that whatever fix you're in, you can get out of it. And a much better translation is resourceful. There is actually no situation that he can't apparently find a way out for himself. But he performs terribly badly in the personnel department. He loses dozens of men, several ships. And there's one attempt at a mutiny, actually, on Circe's island, when he sends forward a reconnaissance party to see if they will get turned into pigs, but doesn't go himself. So, in fact, his poor performance as a leader and benevolent first officer is stressed by the poem. It's as though it celebrates selfish application of cunning.
Lesson one in cunning. Always put yourself first. Cunning is all about you.
Did the Greeks distinguish between good cunning and bad cunning?
The Greeks had several different words that all get translated as cunning. They're shaded from real scurrilous roguery all the way through to the most noble application of foresight and intelligence that you can get. The god who's most associated with cunning is Hermes, otherwise known as Mercury. If you're a thief, you literally have a Hermes shrine in your house. If you are an athlete going for competitions, very interestingly, because they have lots of cheating then, you have Hermes. If you are in business or commerce, you know, market square stuff, then
Hermes. He is the god of stockbrokers. He is actually the god of stockbrokers.
He's the god of stockbrokers. He's the god of 100-meter sprinters who take different sorts of drugs. And it's very much associated with escaping notice. If you were going to do some very public strategic thinking, then you always worshipped Athena. She's the goddess of strategic planning in war, as opposed to thuggish violence. But she's also the goddess of carpentry.
Was it Odysseus who devised the Trojan horse?
It was Odysseus who had the idea for it. Right. You get different versions of the story, but yeah, he was the one who had the idea.
But he was also in the Trojan horse, wasn't he?
He was also in the Trojan horse and actually was one of the ones who took Troy very brutally.
That in itself is kind of interesting because today the cunning man would say, I've got a great idea, build a Trojan horse and I'll stay here. And then after you've cleared out all the Trojans, I'll come in for the photo op. Whereas he actually is in the horse. So he's not just cunning, but he is actually brave.
Yeah.
And also probably realized it would be really good if I was in the horse if we win this thing.
Yeah.
It'll look good on my record.
Yeah. I think Odysseus always had an eye to the epic that was going to be composed about him. And it's often been pointed out, actually, that the only person who actually saw all of the Siege of Troy and all of Odysseus' adventures was Odysseus. All right, so who else could actually be the author of the Iliad and the Odyssey but Odysseus?
Right.
My own personal hypothesis about the Iliad and the Odyssey is that they were composed by Odysseus, a sort of dissolute old sailor on Ithaca, fantasizing.
Why did the Greeks have such a fascination with cunning?
I think it's because they lived on countless coasts and thousands of islands. I think that the interconnection between Odysseus's cunning and the sea, a sea-going nation where you've constantly got to create ships, you've constantly got to survive going abroad and trade. And I think that there is a really clear connection between those two things. You've got to be constantly inventive in the face of the sea.
This aquatic connection with cunning wasn't something that had occurred to me before. Then I scrutinized my own country's coastline, which measures more than 12,000 miles, and considered some of the masters of cunning we've had running the show over the years. You have to concede that Edith might have a point.
We must maintain the integrity of the White House. And that integrity must be real, not transparent. There can be no whitewash at the White House.
From Tricky Dicky to Slick Willie, presidential evasion has become a high art.
But I want to say one thing to the American people. I want you to listen to me. I'm going to say this again. I did not have sexual relations with that woman. Miss Lewinsky, I never told anybody to lie, not a single time, never. These allegations are false.
And then there's the current incumbent, George W. Bush.
He was born in Connecticut. His father was president. How does it come over? Oh, it's some kind of guy from West Texas. Well, now that is cunning. That is politics at the highest level.
Writer, broadcaster and guru of cunning, John Sargent.
The odd thing is, particularly on this side of the pond, is people don't think that's in the least bit impressive. Whereas, of course, if you're anyone following American politics, that's already five-star behaviour.
Can a politician be successful without being cunning?
No. A politician can certainly not be successful without an enormous amount of cunning. You have to be cunning in your ruthlessness. Do you embrace or do you reject? Do you fight or do you cover them with kindness? There's no point in just going around being unpleasant to people, hopeless. No, you've got to make sure that you identify your enemies and you choose the best way of dealing with them. You know, do you, in fact, get someone inside the tent, classic LBJ phrase, or do you leave someone outside who might piss into your tent?
So let's talk about journalism, then. How are journalists cunning?
Journalists, like everyone who's got a trade skill, have got various tricks which they've got to employ. A famous British journalist, Nick Tomlin, wrote a wonderful description of what do you need to be a journalist. And the first thing you need to be was a plausible manner, which is good. Second thing you need is some literary skill. And of course he said some, not a great deal of literary skill. But the last thing was that you need rat-like cunning. And he then answered the question himself. You know, what's an example of rat-like cunning? He said, someone told me another journalist suggested rat-like cunning, and I pinched the idea from him.
But, in fact, that's dishonesty or unethical behaviour, whereas cunning is a form of unethical behaviour.
No, it's not unethical. No, journalists pinch other people's ideas all the time, and that's part of it. If you said, I'm going to just wait until I get the brilliant idea on my own, and I will never repeat anyone else's, goody-two-shoes, lousy journalist. No, a journalist is in a hurry.
When a journalist is doing a story, a journalist is interviewing a person, give me an example of how cunning comes into play.
Cunning comes into play for the working journalist, the working reporter, I suppose in the obvious way that he mustn't look cunning. Anyone who comes through the door to interview someone and you think, he looks sort of shifty, hopeless. No point in doing that. No, the successful journalist does not look cunning. The successful journalist looks as if perhaps he needs a bit of help. That's where the journalist scores. One of my first stories was when I was on the Liverpool Daily Post, and I went to a factory in the centre of Liverpool where someone had died. And I arrived, and I put my notebook on the table, and I said to the manager, "Now just tell me straight what happened." He said, I'm not talking to you. I'm head officer dealing with this. And at that moment, the door opened and the chief reporter on the paper came in. And he said, I'm sorry, I suppose you're not talking about this. And he glanced at me. I suppose you're going to leave it for head office. And the boy said, yes, leaving it for head office. And he said, quite right, said the chief reporter. And he said, that rubble as I came through, was that where the accident happened? Yes. What was it, a 30-foot wall? No, 25-foot wall. Was he new? It was first week. His first week in the... How old was he? 19. And so the reporter then said, obviously head office will be dealing with that. And he then walked out of the yard, and he then ran, once we were outside, to the phone box and dictated the lead story of the Liverpool Echo. Well, that's craft, skill, cunning. It's just how to do it, isn't it?
What John is suggesting is something different from the simple trickery of Odysseus. This is cunning as a survival technique. The origin of the word is helpful here. It comes from the Norse kunna, meaning to know. This implies that it's instinctive, but at the same time, it's something you can learn. I'd go one step further to say that it's essential if you want to survive. I grew up in some fairly rough Philadelphia neighborhoods. Popular mythology tells us that people who survive in such environments are inevitably tough. But the truth is, more often than not, they're cunning. Survivors are smart enough to realize that no matter how tough you are, there are always people who are tougher. You need tactics. You need guile. You need Machiavelli.
Well, I'm Tim Parks. I've lived in Italy for 28 years, writing novels, teaching, translating. I've recently translated Machiavelli's The Prince, a work of immense meticulous effort. So,
let's consider a few aspects of The Prince. It was published in 1531, and among the more notorious conclusions are the following. It is better to be feared than to be loved, if you cannot be both. And if an injury must be done to a man, then it should be so severe that reprisals from his side need not be feared.
Machiavelli is talking in his book about rulers. He understands that all politics is about pure power.
But it also works as a handbook for gangsters. One of the people he writes about is Cesare Borgia, in effect, the Tony Soprano of his day.
For example, when Borgia took La Romagna, it had lapsed into a very chaotic state when bandits were running around doing everything. So he got this guy, Ramiro, with his army and tamed the area. But to do this, Ramiro had been extremely ruthless and there was a big body count. So where does the cunning come in? Borgia intuits that he himself is taking the blame for this ruthlessness, and all of a sudden, there is Ramiro's body in the piazza with his head removed. And Machiavelli says, well, you know, the people were amazed and satisfied. What makes it difficult for the modern reader is simply Machiavelli's acceptance, without discussion, that cruelty might indeed be a necessary factor. Shotgun shine, shake my body, throwing the
red sound. Now take a listen to these two wise guys I interviewed in New York last year and ask yourself what, if anything, has changed in the past 500 years. Somebody once told me that the thing that separates gangsters from other people is that gangsters just go from zero to 60 so fast that they decide, well, now we're going to have violence, and they don't think about it and they just hit people. Is that true?
We speak to a lot of these people, and when you have somebody who's either minorly or really sociopathic, it will just click. It's just a matter of like them pulling out their keys, or they'll punch you in the face. And it just happens really quick. Most fights last 10 seconds.
First punch.
First punch, maybe a second punch and a kick, and it's done. Most people go down after one punch. Gangsters, real fighters know that. If you get the first punch out, you're probably going to win the fight.
So that might be a self-protection mechanism. Oh, there is an inkling of violence here. Let me go ahead and start it so that you see the possible beginnings. You're just going to go ahead and start it so that you don't have to worry about being on the wrong end of it.
Yeah, my dad was just like, if fight's going to happen, throw the first punch. He grew up in the Bronx and he was a Green Beret, so he's got a little bit of an angle on it. But he was like, that's what you do. And if a weapon comes out, if somebody uses a 2x4 or a knife or something like that, run.
Somebody pulls a knife, run.
Another little thing my dad told me about fights, he goes, if you're ever surrounded by a bunch of guys, he goes, punch the biggest guy first, because that'll scare everybody. And the biggest guys usually don't know how to fight, because they never have to. He goes, but watch the smallest guy, because he's probably the most dangerous, because little guys have to fight all the time.
Right. The Napoleon Bonaparte syndrome.
Yeah. Sure. And most of the little guys I know are real ass kickers.
But hold on a second. Is this kind of instinctive, spontaneous violence really the same as cunning? I raise this question because I recently read Suetonius's Lives of the Caesars and was struck by how, after Augustus, all the emperors, with the possible exception of Claudius, were atavistic, murderous brutes. In a way, all the skill and finesse and craft had gone out of the job.
To attain power, you need cunning. To retain power, you just need brute force.
Edith Hall. So what about Machiavelli himself?
I don't think Machiavelli himself made any particular claim to be furbo, to be cunning. He just remarked that this was a huge quality required of a ruler. He was a great womanizer. He had a woman in every town he went to, and he didn't just have women. He fell in love constantly and liked to fall in love.
I don't think that's cunning. No, I think that's a mistake.
Well, in fact,
flat-out mistake.
I didn't suggest that was cunning. I just added it as a... He didn't hide anything from his wife either. He didn't try to be cunning in that sense. So, there's a lot of misnomers about Machiavelli. And there is, in fact, a fantastic naivety about Machiavelli's position, because He sets out to write this book when he himself has fallen out of power and been... He was a diplomat, from head diplomat in Florence for many years. He's fallen out of power. He's been tortured, banished. He's looking for a way back into public life. And he writes this book, which explains how power really works rather than how publicly it's imagined to work. And I think one of the huge ironies of Machiavelli's book is that it actually became an instrument which has helped all of those on the side of the people to understand how their leaders work and to begin to resist it. So it's an intriguing conundrum whether Machiavelli's a heinous fellow or a public hero.
I was going to ask you that, actually, whether cunning was a good or a bad thing.
Well, a cunning, it always has to be contextualized. It's not one of those words like table that we know what we're talking about.
Arson. Arson's another good one.
Arson.
never an upside to arson.
The whole thing really depends at the end on whether you believe there are absolutes in value. And it's already clear in Machiavelli that Machiavelli's clearly not a religious man himself by any means. So I think what we look at when we look at Machiavelli is our own conditioning over many centuries, where there's been this massive attempt to convince us that good Christian values of love thy neighbor and so on are entirely compatible with the workings of power. And probably it's more dangerous to believe as we do than to believe as he did.
Lesson 2 in cunning. The truly cunning man has no morals at all.
You might think that. I couldn't possibly comment.
Have there been times, or have there been people who have looked at the Odyssey and said this is an immoral book precisely because it places so much emphasis on duplicity and cunning?
The Christians, the early Christians, had very great problems, and they had to do all sorts of things to clean up the Odyssey to make it proper for Christians to read, and put extraordinary emphasis on truth and knowledge and opinion and how you got it and how you conducted yourself towards other people. Thou shalt not tell a lie. But the other one, I think, is industrialization. I think you do find a lot of peasant societies. I mean, if you go even today to Greece, they still value wiliness very, very highly. And they will still tell you stories about Robin Hood type figures who steal from the rich to give to the poor. You know, Robin Hood is a cunning hero. But I think those two things, Christianity and industrialization, put the death knell to the trickster.
If the early Christians hated the Odyssey, then consider what the later church made of the prince. Machiavelli's masterpiece was condemned by the Pope and placed on the church index of officially banned books. Presumably, the church didn't want the hoi polloi finding out how power actually worked. But for the Protestants of Northern Europe, the secret was already out, and Machiavelli's book was yet another reason to despise the corrupt Catholic South. It's an attitude that remains to this day. Everyone knows, or at least believes, that Italians are among the most cunning people on earth.
People tend to be very sharp about all kinds of things here, precisely for the reason that a certain element of chaos does reign.
As luck would have it, there had just been a general election when we were there, providing the chance both to talk to a reporter about modern Italian politics and about how cunning modern Italians actually are.
My name is Beppe Severgnini. I was born in Italy, elected a new government just same as the old one.
Is the head of the new government a cunning man?
He is, yes.
In what way?
That he always thinks of the consequences of his action. He wants to get his way one way or another, and he doesn't mind using extraordinary means to obtain ordinary goals. Yes, I like that.
Is cunning respected in Italy?
Yes, not by me, but I would say by most Italians. I think cunning is a pathology of intelligence.
I love that, pathology of intelligence. Can you explain that? That's fantastic.
I'm happy to. I've never used this before, so it is...
It's beautiful. It's
but you know,
beautiful.
You know exactly what I mean. It's good to be intelligent. It's less good to be clever. I mean, it's obvious the difference. In Italian, we have one word, which is intelligente. And intelligence is like fruit. It becomes too ripe and then it rots. And rotten intelligence becomes cleverness.
See, we don't have that in the United States.
You do?
Well, we have ruthlessness more than intelligence. We have people who are determined to do things. Like George Bush is a perfect example, or Hillary Clinton. They're not really clever. They're just determined. And in a certain way, indestructible.
But American cunning is more mathematical. It's a number thing. It's a percentage. It's a probability thing. Italian cunning is more artistic.
Okay. That's another one that I want you to explain. Why is Italian cunning more artistic?
Because it's based on intuition. Intuition means you reach conclusion very, very fast. Italian have in their head something much faster than any Pentium processor, Intel processor, you name it. But it's really fast. There is a wireless system in the Italian head. We know what is happening before it's happening. You know, have you ever asked yourself why is this reputation of Latin lovers? We're not more handsome, we're not more charming, we're not richer, we're not more seductive than others. Simply many Italian boys know what the girls and the women think before they actually think of.
Well, you're certainly better looking than the people that you're being interviewed by today, and certainly better dressed.
That's the advantage of radio. I can tell you you're right when, of course, you're wrong and you're making all this up. But I hope our listeners will believe that. Yes, I look like George Clooney when he was a young man.
You do. It's true. So here I am in northern Italy, the birthplace of Machiavelli, checking out the locals who are parading past on the Feast of San Marco in a parade. They're all Italians. They have all their flags and their costumes. And they all look very cunning. They all look spectacularly cunning. The seniors, elegantly clad in their leatherette jackets. The younger people with their lupine expressions and cunning intellects. Even the children look oddly cunning, as if they're planning their next move. Like how to escape from their grandparents and get out of this parade. In fact, I'm standing here wondering how long I would have to stay here to see a face that isn't cunning. Here comes somebody from Germany. Does it matter to Italian people if politicians appear to be cunning?
No, not at all. Italians voters, they expect politicians to be cunning. Maybe the German vote with their head and the American vote with their heart. Who knows? But we definitely vote with our guts. We don't expect. We don't care about politicians being cunning, about the friends they have, about the things they've done, about the promises they've broken. We just want to keep the other lot out, and we look at someone is sympathetic or is not sympathetic. That's what most people do. Cunning? Of course not.
Even though I'm in Italy, where if cunning, in fact, did not begin, it certainly flourished, it's still very hard to get a feel for exactly what cunning is. In the dictionary, the definition of cunning embraces everything from intelligence to cleverness to deceit. And those terms are not interchangeable. So the concept of cunning clearly means different things to different people. In Italy, when you look at people's faces and you say, well, there's this certain lupine quality to them, they do look cunning. Well, in fact, if everybody looks cunning, how cunning can these people be? Some people, some politicians, Tony Blair is a perfect example, is a politician that you look at him and you go, yes, that is a cunning man. Abe Lincoln, by contrast, was known as Honest Abe, was as cunning as the day was long, but didn't look cunning. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was often described as the lion and the fox, which are two completely opposite things. So it's still difficult to get a firm grip on exactly what cunning is.
The Italians just changed governments again, and the new president there would not be successful in Britain, I assume.
No, that's right. I mean, people would be worried about all sorts of aspects of Berlusconi's past and his present, ownership of the media, planning permission going back a long time, the extent to which he'd be up before the courts. We were horrified when two senior policemen turned up at Downing Street just to talk to the Prime Minister, about honors. Well, I mean, that's rather different from arguing I'm not going to be accused of any crimes while I'm in office. So it is very different, and we are easily shocked by these sorts of things.
I find it very interesting in history how often cunning trumps charisma, and in some cases trumps intelligence. Like, Stalin is cunning, Trotsky's smart, so Stalin wins. And Augustus is cunning, Mark Antony is charismatic. What about in British politics, people like Margaret Thatcher and Tony Blair?
They, of course, would resent the idea of cunning, because cunning sounds bad. But, of course, they were disciplined. What it amounts to for the individual is that they must have control. Margaret Thatcher decided not to fight the miners. She realised they didn't have the fuel supplies, they didn't have the planning. So she waited. Then she took them on, and then she won. And what she also was brilliant at doing, and this was, if you like, cunning, when she got into a fight, she told everybody, I'm into a fight, and I'm going to win the fight. So when she won the fight, she could then repeat everything. Look, I went into this fight because I did all this. So she wrote her own story, her own narrative. Wow. If you can do that, you can then create myths, real important stories, which people will remember for years and years. How do they do it? So Churchill in the Second World War, wonderful moment. For him, perfect. So in a way, these are the great old-fashioned skills of the politician through the ages. And often, the sad truth is, we don't have many great politicians. No. We know what a great politician should do. They should take on enemies and they should beat them. But either the times aren't right, but I think it's a supply problem. You don't get very, very good politicians. They're not, frankly, cunning enough.
Is the Dalai Lama cunning?
The Dalai Lama doesn't... He's not my kind of politician.
Apparently he's not the Chinese government's kind of politician.
No, and I think also the trouble about the Dalai Lama is that, you know, he's there on the hereditary basis, but he doesn't do much for me in terms of wisdom.
But great religious leaders usually are cunning.
Great leaders of any kind, whether they're religious leaders or not, are always cunning.
Bearing this in mind, I thought it would be an easy affair to draw up a cunning roll call of historical greats, those characters who've shown skill far beyond the norm. But there's a problem with this. The truly cunning are rarely seen. So while we have Machiavelli, who wrote a book about cunning, without being cunning himself, and Odysseus, whose most cunning trick may have been to write up his exploits himself, it's difficult to see who else to include. Julius Caesar, perhaps. But then he went and got himself killed. Cardinals Richelieu and Mazarin, yeah, they both passed the test, along with Pope Leo I, who somehow persuaded Attila to refrain from putting Rome to the sword. After that, it gets tricky. Bismarck, for example, the Iron Duke himself, is considered cunning because of his ability to fool his enemies into declaring war and then beat all of them. Politics is the art of the possible, he said, a rule that only the most skillful have been able to pursue. And there haven't been many of them.
To those waiting with bated breath for that favorite media catchphrase, the U-turn, I have only one thing to say. U-turn if you want to.
But was the Iron Lady sufficiently cunning to join this list? Or did she have help?
The lady's not for turning.
You certainly never would have thought she was cunning. I think she actually was very direct.
This is Alistair McAlpine, Lord McAlpine, who worked for 15 years under Margaret Thatcher as the party's treasurer.
I raised the money that kept her party in power. And I felt that she was a prince. She was a prince who could have been better served.
His use of the word prince is deliberate because McAlpine wrote a book called The Servant, based on Machiavelli's work. He was her servant. Maggie was his prince.
Willie Whitelaw was actually very cunning, but people didn't seem to associate him with cunning. It helps to be overweight. People don't think that overweight people are very cunning.
So with his intimate knowledge of what transpires in the smoke-filled back rooms, could McAlpine move us forward in understanding what cunning actually is?
It's a skill like languages or mathematics or whatever. I think these are all skills for a form of success. Nobody ever said to Margaret Thatcher, this is what you should say. They might have said to her, this is how you should say it. In fact, they did. They said, you have to try slightly change your voice because it sounds very strident. The theatrical aspect of politics, which has nothing to do with cunning, is just a technique for presenting a speech. Hitler, for instance, made speeches, important speeches, at sunset. The human mind is most receptive to information at sunset. But that's not cunning. That's a technique. The words you deliver can be cunning. But mostly cunning is just nudging, just little push here, little push there. For instance, in 83, I bought 3,000 copies of the Labour Party manifesto. They were so pleased about it, they announced this to the press, that the Conservative Party bought 3,000 copies of their manifesto. It was known as the longest suicide note in history. I just marked various passages in it and sent it to potential donors. And the money poured in.
Alistair McAlpine, sounding cunning, describing cunning, and simultaneously denying his own innate cunningness.
I don't think I'm particularly cunning personally, but if indeed I was cunning, then I would keep very, very quiet about it.
Cunning is like pornography. You'll know it when you see it.
Do women like cunning men?
No, I don't think they do.
Professor of Classics, Edith Hall.
Most women, I think, find it deeply untrustworthy. Would much rather have a pair of really bulging pectorals. I personally found out very early that I can't deal with very much lying in relationships. Probably because of my Anglican upbringing. But I once tried to have two boyfriends at once, and, you know, my head just cracked up. I could not remember what I'd said to each of them. I just couldn't do it.
So men can do it. Men can handle 3, 4, 5 women at a time.
But do they never slip up on the information?
Men are, they start young and they get really good at it by the time they're about 30. Yeah.
Well, I couldn't. I had to give it up because I couldn't handle the lying.
My name is Kathy Lett. I'm an author and I'm a deranged working mother. Cunning, when it applies to a man, there's this idea of him being, you know, clever and intelligent. But when it's applied to a woman, it's always with a negative connotation. It always means manipulative and sly and conniving. But all women have to be slightly cunning, even to survive marriage, because, you know, most men keep fit by doing step aerobics off their own egos, and confronting them is not going to get you very far. You have to learn to sort of get your own way. So, yes, I would definitely say it's a marital female survival technique.
You can't really survive, I think, ordinary life without having an element of cunning.
John Sargent again.
So that means you certainly don't always tell the truth. Why? Because that would put you into enormous problems. You hold back. You omit. You don't say things. So the idea that a human being could go through life without being cunning, I'm not sure they'd make it to the end.
If you put your mind to it, I think you could achieve anything you wanted.
You might think that, Matty. I'm afraid I couldn't possibly comment.
But can you learn it? Don Herzog, author of an entire book on cunning.
I think you can probably learn to be less of a chump in life. And that comes with some, you know, lessons that also make you less earnest, less open, less trusting, less innocent, more cynical, more jaded. Can you learn? You know, I don't know. I haven't tried. I don't want to try. I don't want to be the kind of person who would excel in that stuff. I think some politicians over their careers clearly get better at it, so I suppose there must be some learning going on.
Don is a professor of law at Michigan University. I'm guessing that had he been more cunning, he'd have taken the pay raise and become an actual lawyer. But I take his point about its effect on making you cynical. The question is, what's the alternative?
Yeah, I'm tempted, in fact, to push hard on that and wonder if the moral man could get away with not being a cunning man. A completely everyday example would run this way. Your vain great aunt comes in with some monstrous pomposity on top of her head and says, "Dear, what do you think of my new hat?" Now, you could tell her, "You shouldn't wear such things. They're repulsive," and she would cry and be miserable for ages. Or you can play along, knowing at some level that she knows the hat is perfectly extravagant and ridiculous, and say, "You look so splendid in your new hat." Now, I actually think that's the right thing to do in all these sorts of everyday settings. But if you were feeling like a stern moralist, you'd have to say, "Look, that was a lie. She asked, 'What did you think of my hat?' And the only truthful answer to that question is, your hat is repulsively ugly." But you don't say that, and I don't think morality requires that you say that.
There's an interesting quote in Herzog's book, From the Devil's Dictionary, which defines cunning as the faculty that distinguishes a weak animal or person from a strong one. Right there, you have a good reason why this is such a problematic word. Most modern Christian societies don't like it. In fact, Edith Hall suggested that after Odysseus, the once openly celebrated trickster became an increasingly marginalized figure, forced to hide his cunning. Alistair McAlpine wasn't the only person we interviewed to say that it was a quality he'd never openly admit to. I think this is the reason that finding an all-encompassing definition, one that sums up all of its virtues and vices, has been so tough. But in Italy, talking appropriately enough to the translator of Machiavelli's The Prince, we found one.
We've been going all along on different parts of the continent trying to arrive at an idea of what cunning actually is. And earlier I was talking about how a few years ago, shortly after 9/11, I was taking a taxi cab to Heathrow, and the man who picked me up, who was a Muslim, and was a very genial fellow, but at one point he said that he just named his son Osama, sort of giggling. And I said, "You weren't really expecting that tip, were you?" So So the point of it was that that man is not cunning, but it's easy to define what isn't cunning, but it's very hard to pinpoint exactly what is cunning. I mean, does it actually describe an attitude? Does it describe a behavior? Does it describe a set of beliefs? What is cunning?
I think what we're talking about is this ability to assess things rapidly and then to act in a way which is not immediately readable, understandable by the people around us, in order to get an advantage that some people will doubtless feel is an unfair advantage.
That is the correct answer, in fact, and we're giving you the keys to the Porsche. We have all of that's the answer.
But just in case you thought we'd finished, we're not quite there yet. There's just one more thing to resolve, and it was John Sargent who found the right words.
When do children start becoming cunning?
Children, of course, teach us everything, don't they? You look at a child and they know particularly how to reply to their advantage. Grandfathers, grandparents generally, they can be ruthlessly manipulated by the smallest child, who does it instinctively, so that the child, I don't know, a few months, I've got two grandchildren, and their skills, their cunning, well, sort of almost the first thing they did. Big eyes, looking at you very closely, holding you tightly with their little fingers. Is that cunning? Well, it's just the start of it all, isn't it?
The Sunday Feature was presented by Joe Queenan and produced in Bristol by Miles Ward.